You are listening to Kubernetes Bytes, a podcast bringing you the latest from the world of cloud-native data management. My name is Ryan Wallner, and I'm joined by Bhavin Shah, coming to you from Boston, Massachusetts. We'll be sharing our thoughts on recent cloud-native news and talking to industry experts about their experiences and challenges managing the wealth of data in today's cloud-native ecosystem. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, wherever you are. We're coming to you from Boston, Massachusetts. Today is April 14th, 2022. I hope everyone is doing well and staying safe. Let's dive into it. So, Bhavin, welcome back to Kubernetes Bytes. It feels like we haven't done this in a while, even though it was just a couple weeks ago. I don't know why that is, but it's good to be back. What have you been up to?
I think that feels like it feels like a long time because we have been doing a lot of planning. So I think we have booked next four episodes, and it still comes out every 2 weeks. So just I think that's it.
Yeah.
But I'm getting ready for trade show season. I think next week I'll be out at AWS Summit in San Fran, and then May we have a whole bunch of these summits, and KubeCon is in May. So I think that's the best time to be a TME, right? Like just going and talking about the products. And this is actually crunch time. So come up with the content and make sure you have all the demos ready to go. But yeah, that's for me.
Yeah, that's right. We have the shows opening back up, the world opening back up. That's exciting for sure to be able to meet up in person. I know I'm excited for KubeCon in just a few weeks, really. And then we're out in LA after that as well. So yeah, I hope it stays that way. We all get to enjoy these trips and really get to, you know, talking to people in person. It's been a while. Cool. Well, today we have a really cool topic. We're going to be talking about Kate Sandra. And we do have a guest, Patrick McFadden. Before we introduce him and dive into the show and get him on here, we do want to cover today's or the last couple weeks of cloud native news. So why don't you dive into it, Bhavin?
Yeah. So we have a whole bunch of funding rounds and an acquisition to discuss today. Let's start with the funding round. So Docker, for people who are still new to this and don't know, maybe this is a good time to learn about what Docker's doing. But they raised a Series C funding round for $105 million. And this is more focused towards developer productivity and making sure that they can spend more time on innovation and writing code and less time on everything else. So they want to speed up the inner loop of the development cycle. And I was reading through that article and I was like, what is inner loop? So and I Googled that and I figured out, okay, inner loop is the process when a developer on his own is writing, building, debugging code in a single machine on their own laptop maybe. And then outer loop is when you hit it, submit it for version control, and then you let the CI/CD system test it. So I think Docker's focus is to make sure inner loop is performing better. So like developers are more productive, and then passing it on to other orchestration systems or deployment systems.
Interesting. I don't think I've actually heard of that term either. So that's a new one for me.
Apparently it's a thing for a couple of years now.
All right. Now you learn something new every day. I think Docker's done a great job of sort of pivoting to really focus on developers. So I love to see the new funding.
Awesome. The second company, another startup, Garden.io, they raised Series A round of $16 million. And the blog said to combat waste in cloud development. So again, I had to like dig a bit deep and find out, okay, what do they actually mean by it?
Catchy.
So one of the stats that they highlight based on a survey that they had done last year was cloud developers only spend 11% of their time on average actually writing code. And then everything else is just spent on building and maintaining internal tools, setting up dev environments, debugging pipelines, and so on and so forth. Garden.io wants to make all of this easier. And their approach is, okay, large distributed apps were not supposed to run, like the whole app, you can't run on a single laptop inside a dev environment. They want you to have a production-like hosted dev environment that is in sync with your dev or your SDE. So whenever you make any changes, if you have the dev mode enabled, those changes are directly reflected into the hosted environment without you having to build a container image or push it through your CI/CD pipeline and then figure out how the change impacted the rest of the application. So all of this sounds really cool. It's still Series A. So they have a few customers listed, but it would be a good company to watch out for. And then we, from an acquisition perspective, our friends at NetApp acquired InstaCluster. And InstaCluster is a database as a service company. I think they are focused on deploying and offering a managed service for different databases in the cloud. And just looking at their website, they offer PostgreSQL, Kafka, OpenSearch, Cassandra, Redis, and Zookeeper. So a few services that customers can just leverage for leverage as hosted databases in the public cloud. So
yeah, it will be really interesting to see what that becomes inside NetApp. A lot of really exciting stuff.
Yep. And then we have, since we are recording this on April 14th, I think in a couple of weeks, we'll have Kubernetes 1.24 out. So May 3rd is the official release date right now for the release. And this release will have an interesting change where Docker Shim, which was deprecated for the past three releases, is officially getting removed. So people who are running Kubernetes clusters, they need to run, just make sure that they are ready for the new release when they upgrade. This means that if you are running the Docker runtime as the container runtime on your Kubernetes node, you need to change that to use Containerd. If you are using Docker to just build your applications or build those container images, you don't have to worry about it. If you are running any public cloud managed Kubernetes services, they have defaulted to Containerd for a while. So you can just verify, but don't worry, you would most likely be running Containerd. We link to a blog in the show notes, which walks you through a few commands that you can use to check the runtime on your nodes. And then if it is Docker, how you can uninstall that and install Containerd and then use that as part of your node. So a really good thing to keep an eye out for since we are approaching the release date for 1.24.
Great.
And then next thing I had was another day zero vulnerability. Again, these keep coming up, and something that we should keep an eye out. It's called Spring for Shell. There are again, it is similar to log4shell or log4j vulnerability that was announced earlier this year. It allows people to do remote code execution, and it is specifically for environments that are running JDK version 9+. And then a couple of, if you should be running Tomcat server, and like there are certain conditions that you have to meet to be exposed to this vulnerability. So make sure you read the blog post, understand if your environment is vulnerable or not, and then apply the necessary mitigation that's already available for you. With that, I think the next thing on our list is discussing the latest version of Portworx Enterprise 2.10, something that both of us are really excited about. I know it's a big release for us, a few key features introduced. I'll get started with one, and then you can add on to it as well. Sure. The feature that I am excited about is application IO control. So that allows administrators or platform admins or DevOps admins, whatever the role may be, they can now specify IOPS and throughput limits, both for read and write, for any persistent volume that's running on a Portworx storage cluster. So this means that if you want any new volumes to have that limit specified, you can update your storage class definition and use a couple of parameters to either set the bandwidth limits or IOPS limits for your storage class. And then any persistent volume that gets provisioned using that storage class will automatically inherit those settings. And then for existing customers who want to start using this as part of the 2.10 release cycle, they can go ahead and use our pixiekernel or pxctl utility to basically add a parameter to the persistent volume, and the limits take effect almost instantaneously. So that's like for me. What about you, Ryan?
Yeah, there's a lot of great stuff. We actually released a shared v4 services quite some time ago. It's been in beta for a while. With this release, it becomes full GA. So that's taking basic NFS volumes, and you can access them in and outside the cluster. It's highly scalable and fails over by itself. So that can be, you know, fully GA'd now. There's also one that I love, which is called Trashcan, Portworx Volume Trashcan. It works a lot.
Great job, like naming it.
Sorry. Yes, yeah. Trashcan. You can't go wrong with Trashcan when you talk about something like this. I mean, recycling bin on Mac, mm-hmm. I believe, but it works the same way, right? So you delete a file on your computer. It's not actually completely gone. It's just in your trash can. It's in your recycling bin, and you got to go in there and fully delete it so it's, you know, evaporated forever. The same idea here. You can set sort of an expiry on volumes, and if something were to occur, such as an administration error, or if you have your reclaim policy set to delete and you didn't mean to, and you delete an object and your volume gets deleted, your data is still safe in this scenario until your expiry runs out, and you can recover those volumes and trash can back into your environment in Kubernetes, and really helps with that sort of oops, data loss, lost my wallet feeling, and a really cool feature to check out. There's also some great stuff around AutoFS trimming and volume placement strategies for stateful sets, meaning you can, you know, basically define a stateful set and a volume placement strategy specifically for the pod in that unique deployment, and it'll group your volumes or do what you want to do, anti-infinity for those kind of things. So really, really exciting release for Portworx for sure. In addition to that, I just have a couple more here. There's an article about etcd 3.5 specifically for 0, 1, and 2 versions, which basically has a data inconsistency issue. So if you're running etcd 3.5, 0, 1, or 2, you definitely want to take the link in the show notes, which can actually lead to certain corruption issues. You can check your clusters. We recommend not upgrading to 3.5 and waiting till 3.5.3 release is out, and that will be fixed. So definitely go ahead and check that. Etcd is a big part of all cloud native applications or Kubernetes in general. So definitely something to go check out. And then this last one is Postgres container apps. I thought it was a really cool article by Crunchy. Crunchy Data came out with this basically way to extend the internal Postgres deployment to be able to run a container. So there's this little create extension and run container method that you can actually run a container from within the PostgreSQL CLI, and it'll run a Docker container with something that you want to do, you know, good for kind of quick and dirty metrics, deployments, those kind of things. If you don't want to go through the trouble of fully deploying your Kubernetes sort of init containers and things like that, or sidecar containers, which probably is still the way I see running in production happening, but definitely a cool little way to see sort of the ability of running containers to make it into the application. So go check that out as well. And I think with that, Bhavan, that's all our news. It might have been a lot of news, but I think those are all really worthy articles. So we can dive into our topic today on Kate Sandra. And again, our guest is Patrick McFadden. He is the co-author of the upcoming O'Reilly book, Managing Cloud Native Data on Kubernetes. And he currently works at DataStax in the developer relations group and as a contributor to Apache Cassandra project. So really excited to get Patrick on the show. So let's go ahead and do that.
Awesome. So we have Patrick on the call now. Patrick, welcome to Kubernetes Bytes. We are so glad to have you on to talk about Cassandra. Why don't you introduce yourself and tell us what you do?
Yeah, hi. Well, thanks for having me today. Let's see, what do? I do lots of things right now, mostly work on open source things. And what are those? So my name is Patrick McFadden. I work at DataStax. We're a database company, mostly cloud now. And we do actually all things data. You'll hear me say the open data stack a lot. It just kind of worked out with our name. But I work... I've been working on Apache Cassandra for over 10 years now. I've been part of the project for a long time. Apache Pulsar is another project I have involvement in. Spark, less now, more before. But also lately, a lot of Kubernetes stuff. Right now, I'm in the middle of writing a book with my co-writer, Jeff Carpenter, called Managing Cloud Native Data on Kubernetes, which is... a ridiculously large topic that we're trying to squeeze into a book form. We're about 3/4 of the way through. You can get early access now. That's out there. Thanks to Portworx. Thank you. I think part of that part of that writing of that, it probably will be very helpful for some of the things I've learned for your listeners.
Awesome. Like, we'll definitely include a link for those early access, as the 75% of the book that you mentioned, so people can download it and start reading it. But like, okay, you already spoke about the topic for today, right? It's Cassandra. Can you like tell our listeners what Cassandra is? How is it different from other data services or databases out there? And why are we talking about Cassandra on Kubernetes at all?
Why even talk about that, right? Cassandra is one of those databases that affects your daily lives. And I love that fact because I've been working for a long time to make that a reality. But it's a NoSQL database. It was in that early days of NoSQL in the 2008-2010 years that is when we were trying to figure out how to scale data. And this was one of the solutions, and it's really taken off. It's a very popular database. But essentially what it is a shared nothing database, fully distributed. It leans more towards the availability and partition tolerance. So one of the useful and great features of Cassandra is that it holds up to a lot of abuse. So you can lose an entire data center, or you can lose half of your cluster, things like that, and it'll still keep tracking. These are just the way that it's been built. These aren't new features. These are just from day one. This is how it works. And working with it is a different kind. It's a different type of database, and I spend a lot of my time helping people build applications. But it's a transactional database. It's better closer to your users, and it's why on Kubernetes, because it actually has always followed the same suit of the ideals of Kubernetes, which is this always on, the self healing. It scales in a linear fashion so that if you need more, you add more. It is a really great way, the elasticity, which is becoming more a part of it, is a great way to manage costs. This is a typical problem with Kubernetes and cloud is you always add infrastructure and you forget to remove it. It's really good for that. And the resilience is a key thing, just thinking about, if you run infrastructure, that eventually something's going to fail, and probably a lot of something. And what does it mean to your customers? So Kubernetes, Cassandra, they both follow that same thing of you should be online as much as possible.
That's like a great way to put it together. But okay, so how do I get started with Cassandra on Kubernetes? I know there is a project called K8Sandra. How do you say it? Let's start there.
Yeah, how do you say that? Yeah, I know we got clever inside, and it's funny how this has been the problem, but it's K8Sandra, as in Kate, the name Sandra.
Now we know. Now everybody knows.
Yeah, now everyone knows because you're 1 or 2 million listeners. I can't remember. It was a huge number. But, they're all going to be like, oh, now see, when you're at a party and you talk about it, you can sound super cool. Mm-hmm. And if somebody mispronounces it, you can sound pretentious. Like, I'm sorry. No, it's Kate Sandra. Because there's people out there listening that do that. They're actually, this is how we do it.
It'll be one of those kubectl and kubectl things.
Oh, yeah. Well, this kind of dates me, but when Linux first started to become a thing, there were people that called it Linux.
Ah.
Oh.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. That was a faux pas.
Super quickly, I think.
But it's not Linux?
Yeah. Well, it's because everyone tried to make it Unix. It's Linux. Get it?
At least it's not awkward. Linux. Yeah.
Yeah. Nerds are fine. The Cassandra project is it's another open source project. It's not in CNCF yet, or in Linux Foundation yet. But it's a project that DataStax has sponsored to change the way we deploy Cassandra and just make it completely Kubernetes native. Cassandra is a large distributed system, and to install it, you gotta be ready for that. And wouldn't it be great if you could just do a Helm install Cassandra and have a running Cassandra cluster? That's what it's about.
But
yeah, wouldn't it be great?
here's the secret, right? So, I mean, you know, it being sort of the project to really run Cassandra on Kubernetes, maybe we can talk about some of the challenges of not using a project like Cassandra, and what are some of the challenges of deploying Cassandra on Kubernetes without an operator, and what does it solve?
Yeah, well, you know, this is a classic open source problem. Mm-hmm. The reason Cassandra exists is because DataStax was solving this problem. And we went down, so we have Astra, which is our Cassandra as a service. And you know, that's a cool cloud native service. You just click a button, you get a Cassandra cluster. But you know, like when you're building a SaaS product, clicking a button and you get a thing, there's like a bazillion things behind it, right? The first incarnation of Astra was not Kubernetes based, and it was not easy to run. It took a lot more humans than we needed, and it wasn't as robust, and it just had all the like every tagline you can think of from KubeCon of like, why we switched to Kubernetes. And mm-hmm. we went through the process of converting all our infrastructure to Kubernetes, and in that process we learned a lot about running large scale stateful workloads in Kubernetes to a point where, you know, we felt okay like putting up an SLA, and that all that knowledge we were able to and because we're an open source company, we believe this should be in the open source. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. our operator, and then eventually Cassandra, and there are more innovations coming, but you know, it's taking what we've learned running a cloud service with Cassandra and open sourcing it.
Okay, like that's really cool, right? I didn't know Astra was running on Kubernetes. Like Astra basically deployed Cassandra instances on Kubernetes. So that's awesome. And you're taking all of those learnings and putting it out there for everyone to leverage. That's great. but like, okay, how do I like get started, right? Like it's open source, but how do I run it against my Kubernetes cluster? Do I have to create a 1,000 line YAML file for it? Or how easy it is to get started?
Oh, come on now. If you start with Kubernetes, you know there's going to be YAML in your life.
Right.
Well, hopefully not much. If you go to Cassandra.io, which is it's K8Sandra.io. Mm-hmm. Just make sure we get that. we have a getting started that will take any and all environments you can think of. Like we can do it locally with Minikube. We can do it on any cloud provider. As a matter of fact, like all the cloud providers now have Kubernetes as a service. We have startup for that. But mm-hmm. the simple getting started steps are, you know, getting the Helm chart installed in your local repo. Yes, there is a YAML file, and the bare minimum is pretty minimum. It's like, yeah, this is my image. This is the namespace I'm installing it in, and here's how many mm-hmm. nodes I need. Walk away. And because I know you're really excited about this, you can go much crazier with that YAML file if you want. but that's enough to get like a small 3-node cluster running on Minikube.
Okay. And all the smart defaults that you have, like it will store like 3 replicas, like the replication factor will be set to 3 and nodes will be configured according to best practices.
Yeah. And I know something near and dear to your heart. Then you get into like, what kind of storage are you going to use? And, as with any stateful workload, storage is pretty important aspect of that. In sure. Minikube, you know, you're going to use local files.
Yep.
But as you evolve your footprint, you're going to be thinking about, all right, what storage, how am I going to store this data? And we really push hard on, you got to make sure that you use a good class of storage. Storage is kind of the make or break for a good running cluster. So that's the first thing. And then the second thing is making sure you have a good clean network because it's a distributed system.
Right. You mentioned something before, right, that, you know, you have Astra and Cassandra both as sort of an offering to deploy Cassandra in various ways. Now, I'm curious, right, who's the Cassandra project really tailored to versus why wouldn't you just go and deploy using Astra? You know, who comes to one of those services versus the other?
Yeah, and I don't think this will be a surprise to anybody. There's a lot of folks out there that are not trustful of handing over their infrastructure to a service provider just yet. As much as Amazon, Google, and Microsoft have told you, oh, just leave the driving to us. It's still like EC2 still exists, you know? But it's those, I think what it comes down to is there's a lot of companies that are standardizing around Kubernetes and want to own their own infrastructure, their own infrastructure story. And that's okay. I mean, and what's interesting is that, and this is what I've talked to a lot of folks in our industry, like especially around data, is that data is kind of the crown jewels. You know, that's the thing that they want to hold on to. Mm-hmm. Don't hand your data to a cloud, because then you're locked in. And the clouds threw in the towel a while back, and they said, yeah, okay, Kubernetes is a thing. And now they all have standard Kubernetes services. So you have a very portable, you know, I mentioned this in my book, shameless plug, that, you know, we went from creating virtual machines and using virtual machines and eventually containers. Now we're creating with that big YAML file that you love so much, Bhavan. Mm-hmm. We're creating virtual data centers, and we're deploying that in the cloud and we're just renting the compute network and storage as a commodity. And when you know you're going to get this best in class database, the thing that like runs Netflix and Apple and all these other companies, and you can just deploy it anywhere you want and pay for it as a commodity, those are the companies that are thinking about doing like a Kate Sandra in their own Kubernetes.
Oh, interesting. Okay, like an add-on service to add like on top of a managed Kubernetes service. Interesting.
That is the trend. Yeah, it's, nope. You know, because I think we should be done inventing new infrastructure. You know, we have plenty of databases, plenty of streaming, plenty of analytics. We're moving into an era with Kubernetes and cloud that we can, it's more about the architecture, mm-hmm. like how we assemble the parts, than how, if we need to build like yet a new database. We should get away from that.
Okay. I can get on board with that idea. But okay, so we spoke about like how we can get started with Kate Sandra. But the reason, like one of the main reasons I had reached out to you was to talk about the latest feature or latest release of Kate Sandra, which covered that multi-cloud or multi-data center deployment. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, well, that goes into what I was talking about is, mm-hmm. you know, when you're in control of your own destiny, sometimes you want to have choices installed in your architecture. Mm-hmm. And it's very typical to see any company that's on a cloud journey, you know, the quote unquote cloud journey, yep. It starts with one step. it's download Boto. did I call myself? the cloud journey is usually like, oh, we're going to do a little bit in the cloud and a little bit on-prem. Well, Kubernetes in that environment, you just got yourself a multi-cluster problem. Mm-hmm. Kubernetes doesn't span hybrid like that. So you have to start thinking about that. Another thing that's really turning out to be super common is large companies have their footprint in more than one cloud. Two or three sometimes. And yeah, there's transit costs. Yeah, there's other things, but there's also this feeling that you're not stuck in one place. Mm-hmm. And managing that is tough. So it's, and for the Cassandra project, one of the things that people didn't like about Kate Sandra is that it held back the superpower of Cassandra because it didn't allow for multi-data center, which is kind of a fundamental thing. So with this release, the latest release 1.2, we have all the mechanisms in there where you can manage Cassandra across multiple Kubernetes clusters in one control plane command. So if you need to expand, contract, do all those things, it will look at the entire Cassandra cluster as one thing, even though it spans multiple data centers, multiple Kubernetes clusters. It's just easier for operators overall.
I know, and like looking at a blog that was published around this, right? And it's like so simple. Like I can just have different data centers defined, and I can still specify how many Cassandra nodes I want in each data center, what their size and like heap size should be. And it, everything is just put together for you. So I don't have to worry about even logging into different clusters and deploying those Kubernetes pods or stateful sets or however you want to deploy your Cassandra instance. So like this, again, like this simplifies it so much. It's hard to put in words on a podcast, but yeah. I'm just happy.
Well, that I'm glad you said that. Thank you for making that point, because if I made it, it would sound totally derived. But you saying it is so much better. But you know, dude, that's the thing that we're trying to create. Is I really don't want the next generation of infrastructure people to go through what I went through with the infrastructure.
But we won't evolve. Have as interesting stories then.
Oh, yes, they will. Let's have different stories. You could do a kubectl command and completely destroy your entire virtual data center in one command.
Nice. You're not supposed to talk about that command.
Yeah, kubectl delete, what? Yeah.
Cool. Good to know. And yeah, I know that, you know, the CAS operator, which is also from DataStax, is now in favor of Cassandra, right? And I think I've used that in the past as well. So it's worth calling out, because part of me wondered, what's the difference? And then I went and looked, and it was just like, go use this thing. So, you know, I don't know what the status of that, if you have anything to say about that as well.
Well, the Cassandra project is kind of a collection of operators in a lot of ways. Because it's not just Cassandra that it installs. It also installs a backup tool called Medusa. And there's another, hang on to your hat, tons of Greek mythology in here. and then there's another tool called Reaper that does like background repair processes. Mm. So it is meant to be kind of like the batteries included thing. Like when you do a Helm install, then you should get all the stuff that someone may have to go through a few training classes to learn how to run a Cassandra cluster. So, and each one of those things has an operator. And we have, you know, we have this situation where, you know, we can make it easier, but operators are the ones that are like the robots, right? I love that analogy of the operators, like the robot in your data center that, takes the commands and does stuff. Well, when we have, again, when we're creating these multi-process architectures, then we need more than one robot. And so having more operators is not a bad thing.
Awesome. So, okay. Can you talk about like a few customer case studies around like people, how they're using Cassandra or Katesandra, sorry, for their deployments, like on their DIY clusters?
Yeah, I don't know how many names I can. I mean, it's so funny, you know, the infrastructure is. People are like, "Well, we don't want to give away our secret sauce," but
just use wavy hands.
Yeah, there's. Yeah, exactly. there is. Yeah, if I tell you, then you're going to go out and this is the thing that I love about Netflix. They will totally tell you how they do everything. They got so much swagger, right? They're like open source everything. They talk about everything. Like, this is how we built it. Go ahead and try.
I dare you.
Oh wait. Yeah. So that's a great analogy of like, yeah, sometimes it's not the tool, it's the people. But yeah, there's a company that in the UK that does a lot of really cool stuff around Cassandra, and what they're using it for specifically is managing their on-prem and multi-cloud presence. They provide a API control plane for all the developers who do above the line for mobile, web, that sort of thing. And they use Cassandra quite a bit for that, because Cassandra is just default active-active multi-cluster, multi-data center. But moving to Cassandra, you know, it's, if you look at like how people have adopted Kubernetes, you know, they've already got all their more their stateful or stateless infrastructure running Kubernetes for years now, microservices, that sort of thing. Getting out of the business of having two different deployment mechanisms and two different CI/CD pipelines and unifying them was a big deal. And now for them, I think what they're seeing is, you know, they can move on to do other things. You know, they've figured out that the robot running their Cassandra cluster is doing the job for them. And it wasn't as painful as they thought. I think there was a lot of fear around running stateful workloads inside of Kubernetes. Mm-hmm. And as long as you get to storage right, you're golden. So yeah, I wish we had more names and we could talk about, but yeah, it'll come around. We need a conference.
Yes. There may be one coming up soon. We'll know.
Yeah, I heard. Yeah. Yeah.
Nice. So, you know, I think there's always a what's next, right? And there's a what's next in Kubernetes, and there's a what's next for DataStax and Cassandra. Now, I'm curious, you know, where do you see sort of, you know, are we still at the beginning of people adopting, right? As your example just stated, people are still a little fearful putting stateful stuff on Kubernetes. Are we still the beginning there? What's next for, you know, Cassandra, and then maybe in your view, with Kubernetes?
Well, another disclosure. I'm very involved in the data on Kubernetes community, so I'm mm-hmm. kind of converted at this that. Point. but that community has done some really good work in trying to understand like who's doing this and how many of us are doing it. Mm-hmm. And there's a recent survey that showed that companies that are moving fast and are making a difference with Kubernetes have already adopted data inside of Kubernetes. Mm-hmm. It's the biggest open secret. So it's not so taboo anymore. But like what's next and what does that mean is, you know, there's this problem that I think we're solving slowly or quickly, depending on who you talk to. If it's, if you talk to the, infrastructure people building it, it's too fast. If it's the business people, it's too slow. Yeah. but we have had a really established large group of data infrastructure software out there that's been proven battle hardened, and it was never designed to work on or in or around Kubernetes. And that's changing rapidly. Now I can speak specifically about Cassandra. Cassandra is just meant to be working on, it works in any kind of environment. It's very commodity based, as we put it. But mm. now we're starting to move Cassandra closer to Kubernetes. At DataStax, we're looking at specific things like what things do Kubernetes provide that are redundant in Cassandra? For instance, consensus mm. and control plane management. That's built in. Kubernetes has that for free. And treating a database more like a microservice instead of mm. a monolithic beast to be installed. Mm-hmm. And we, I think this is going to change a lot. Again, this is from our running Cassandra at scale in Astra. You know, we have thousands of clusters in there. You learn a few things. So it's this cloud natifying of the older versions of things. That's really what's next for the industry, and definitely what's next for Cassandra and Cassandra.
Interesting. Yeah, I think, you know, to me, that sounds like it could be a huge benefit in making it even more scalable as it already is, right? Being it potentially more lightweight, letting Kubernetes do more of things. It's interesting to see how, you know, Kubernetes will evolve into, you know, into where it will actually play in the role of applications. Because, you know, you mentioned it before that, you know, we're now putting together the pieces. We're focusing more on the business value of the application these days mm-hmm. in many ways rather than just building and exploring Kubernetes, right? We've definitely mm-hmm. adopted it by now. So it's interesting insight.
Mm-hmm. I think, yeah. I know we already covered what's next, but I did want to like ask another question, maybe that should have been before, but around data protection. I know we spoke about how Cassandra, I'll eventually learn how to say it. Cassandra is that one big umbrella that has different operators. I was reading through the 1.2 release notes, and then it says Medusa might be missing, or it might not support this multi-data center. Is that something that's coming in the future? How does Cassandra handle data protection?
Yeah. So data protection in Cassandra is a fascinating and fun topic because it, just inherently it, the way it's designed is to protect your data, you know? So, you can get into this mode where you think maybe I don't need a backup ever. not in a traditional sense. Like I used to be an Oracle DBA. And if you didn't backup your, you know, you didn't do your incrementals and backup your database all the time, you were just asking for data loss. But the funny thing about my experience with Oracle, which is the thing about data protection inside of a Cassandra cluster, is I never had to restore a database because of a hardware failure, ever. I always had to restore databases because some programmer munged the actual data. You know, so like
equally important,
I deleted everything. Yeah. yeah. And I'm, you know, that's a real problem, is it's easy to, ruin your data with a command and then what, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Human error, right. Whether it's an operator, dev, admin, you know, I think there's many ways to munge what could be a Cassandra data loss issue, whether it's from a Kubernetes administration point of view, or like you said, from a developer or Cassandra operator, it sounds like.
Yeah. So like the data protection in that realm, like let's reset the problem. It's not because hardware failed. It's not because we lost our cluster. It's because, you know, somebody did something. Now we can go further down, like for recovery, but so backup should always, you should always be doing snapshots inside of Cassandra, and that's what Medusa does.
Okay.
And Medusa manages that pretty well. Where you put your snapshots, a very important topic. You know, it's, do you put it in slower storage? Do you put it in more, you know, like cheaper, bulkier storage? That's important. And then there's this aspect of what if somebody does delete your entire cluster? Having your storage configured so that it doesn't, you know, your PVs don't just drop out and delete themselves. That's important because that's a fast way to get a cluster back online, is restoring the nodes and reattaching the PVs. So you can get a cluster running pretty quickly based on that, if you lost everything, for instance. And then there's the long-term storage data protection, like especially in regulated environments, financials, health, is, you know, storing a snapshot at a certain time and then putting it in the coldest cold storage, cheapest storage you possibly can, because it, you know, it's got to be held for what, 7 years or something like that. Yep. So, you know, these are not all Cassandra topics, but these are ones that anyone managing a Cassandra cluster should really be thinking about all the time.
Good to know. Okay, we'll add it to our list. But with that, like, I think I'm ready for my final question. Like, how do we learn more about Cassandra? How do we get started? I know personally, to get ready for this podcast episode, I did go through the YouTube series that you have on data science developers about Intro to Cassandra. But apart from that, what other resources are available?
Yeah, I mentioned before, but just reiterating, Cassandra.io, it should be your first stop. The docs are really awesome. And if they aren't, we always accept PRs. It's a really cool setup, by the way. If you don't like it, you click a button on the page, edit it, and it will turn into a PR automatically.
Nice.
Yeah. But Cassandra.io is a great place to get started. And as a matter of fact, if you really don't want to do anything, Cassandra is available in Google and Amazon Marketplace as well. So you can just go over there and click a button and it'll do it for you, which is pretty slick.
We just did
Amazon sponsored this fun thing that we did with Cassandra, where we built a 1,000-node cluster
nice.
Using Cassandra, which it was cool. A lot of money, but Amazon wanted to show off the marketplace, like, oh look, you can just go into marketplace and spin up thousands of dollars worth of infrastructure in seconds, isn't this great?
create your own Netflix if you so choose.
Yeah, exactly. I don't even think Netflix has more than 1,000 nodes, but not in one cluster.
There you go.
Yeah. But yeah, if you want to get started, and then we have a Discord. If you want to get in and talk with us, it's pretty active Discord. The links are in Cassandra.io. We use GitHub discussions for a lot of things as well. We have Discourse out there. Just, you know, join in the community. We would love to hear from you and talk about your use case and if we could help make it better.
Anything going on at KubeCon Valencia? Will you be there?
I'm not going to be there in person. Huh? I'm still doing the virtual thing, but I do have a talk that I'm doing.
Nice.
I'll be at Data on Kubernetes Day, which is a couple days before.
Great.
It's KubeCon is turning into like a festival, right? There's like other conferences popping up around KubeCon now.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'll be there. So I'll be giving talks at all those places. Yeah.
Great. Well, I think we'll definitely include all of those links in the show notes for anyone who's listening that wants them. And you can go get started with Kate Sandra, learn how to say it, learn how to deploy it, whatever you want to do. And I will say, Patrick, it's been a pleasure having you on the show today. And I know I learned a lot. And so hopefully those listening did as well.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me. This has been fun. And I really hope to hear from some of your listeners on Discord. You know, just say shout out, you know. Hey, I heard your talk. I want to join in. Would love to have you.
Sounds good.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Well, that was a great conversation with Patrick. I have definitely learned new things about Cassandra, Kate Sandra, and all the ways you can deploy it and leverage Cassandra as a NoSQL distributed database for your applications.
One day, Bhavin, you will say Kate Sandra correctly.
Yes.
And I will applaud you now that we know how to say it properly because Patrick gave us the hint.
Thank you, Ryan. So why don't you kick us off with the takeaways?
Sure. I think the big one for me is, you know, the world of managed services and BYOK, bring your own Kubernetes, is going to exist, you know, for the future, right? You know, the comments around organizations really wanting to still own the stack, even though they're putting Legos together to a certain extent, now that a lot of these pieces of the architecture are becoming more mature, they can kind of pick and choose which ones they want to build themselves, which ones they want to buy, but ultimately they still want to have their hands on that infrastructure, own their own data, you know, for those that don't want to give away that sort of to these managed services. But there's a world for both of them. And that's what I heard, right? And the BYOK, as I want to coin it, if it's not already coined, BYOK, I like that one, is definitely something we're going to see going forward. And we're only at the beginning, I think, of people building their own Kubernetes architecture. So really cool that Astra and both Kate Sandra can live in the sort of the same ecosystem for data stacks.
Yeah, and for me, right, just learning that Astra actually, like the managed service that DataStax has, runs on Kubernetes. Like, I loved how Patrick laid out the whole journey, right? Like, they didn't used to use Kubernetes. They used to run it without Kubernetes and offered that managed service. But then they eventually realized that to run this Cassandra, to run these Cassandra instances at scale, you would really benefit from having an infrastructure like Kubernetes. So that was eye-opening for me. And then again, I think I've repeated this during the episode, but I really wanted to talk about the multi-cloud or multi-data center support that Kate Sandra's new operator has. It allows you to leverage Cassandra's distributed architecture. So you like how you can have different data centers of Cassandra, and you can get immediate consistency or read and write operations by using the defaults. So like the replication factor of 3 and just having different rings across different regions. But now the newest version of operator, how it has made this easier to set up for anybody who uses Kubernetes. That's really great. Like, people should really check it out. We'll definitely include a link to a demo or a blog in the show notes. But yeah, those were the couple of takeaways that I had from this episode.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really like that as well. Just, you know, really, really kind of doubling down on the operator pattern, something that Cassandra's already really good at doing, but have to manually do those things to set mm-hmm. it up and having the operator do that. Really, really exciting stuff. And I like where that's going. So with that, you know, all the show links that we mentioned and Patrick mentioned in here will be posted with this episode. So definitely go take a look at those, the KateSandra.io, docs, YouTube series, those kind of things. We will also encourage you to go check out our other episodes on Apple Podcasts, or if you go to Anchor anchor.fm/KubernetesBytes. You can take a look at all our episodes there and even send us a message for how we're doing or what you want to hear or who you want to hear as a guest. That would be great. And please leave a review if you so choose. So next week, or sorry, I always do that, 2 weeks from now, is we're going to be talking about MySQL, a really exciting episode. So we're kind of sticking with this database theme as we're going forward for the short term. And that's the end of the episode. So, you know, I'm Ryan.
I'm Bhavin.
And thanks for joining another episode of Kubernetes Bytes.
Thank you for listening to the Kubernetes Bytes podcast.